Happy 4th of July. For many of us, this is a day for cookouts and fireworks, but it is also a chance to think about freedom, including the freedom to decide what it means to be an American. We thought this would be a good day to hear encore conversations with people who've thought a lot about who they are and want to be and how they express that. And we are going to start with a story about crime and forgiveness. You might remember that in the days after the September 11th terrorist attacks, there was a spate of attacks on individuals who were perceived to be Muslim or Arab. One victim of those crimes was Rais Bhuiyan. He is a former Bangladeshi Air Force officer who was living in Dallas, Texas. He was working at a gas station when a man named Mark Stroman walked in, asked him where he was from, and then shot him in the face. Bhuiyan was one of three South Asian immigrants shot by Mark Stroman, but Bhuiyan was the only one who survived. He was badly injured and very much traumatized, but what he chose to do with that pain is remarkable. He not only decided to forgive his attacker, but he also campaigned to save him from the death penalty. That story is detailed in the book, The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. Earlier, I spoke with the author of the book, New York Times columnist Anand Giridharadas. He began by telling me about Rais Bhuiyan's life before the attack.
Rais Bhuiyan grows up in Bangladesh, and he has this energy and vitality in him from a very young age that propel him from one success to the next, getting into a hard-to-get-into military boarding school, then getting into the Air Force Academy, then getting into the Air Force, then realizing, you know what, I kind of want to move to America because things are really happening over there in IT, getting a visa on his eighth try, finally getting to America and realizing that, you know, New York's great, but he's got this friend in Dallas, calls him, says, come visit Dallas. He goes to Dallas and he realizes, you know, the bathrooms in Dallas are as big as the bedrooms in New York. New York's kind of like Dhaka. It's a big, crowded, honking city. I'm going to try this Dallas thing. Open space, low taxes. So he goes. And a few months after getting to Dallas, working in a convenience store of a gas station to try to kind of build his way towards this dream of working in IT, he gets shot in the face. And that's where Mark Stroman comes in. Mark Stroman is kind of an angry white guy, calls himself a true American patriot. In and out of prison and various things since he was a young man, and becomes convinced in the days after 9/11 that his country has been attacked in a way that must be answered, that the Bush administration will be too timid to do anything about it, and that he, Mark Stroman, needs to take care of it himself, and does so by going to three gas stations in the Dallas area, walking in, seeing someone look what he called kind of Arab to him, and shooting the clerk in all three cases.
Now, a lot of people who listen to this program will recognize you and your name from your insights on international economics, from your reporting on political and economic developments in India, where you were a correspondent. What drew you to this story?
Right after college, after growing up in the United States, I moved to India, broadly telling the story of how an old and stagnant country was suddenly waking up. And I came home back to America in 2009 after telling that story and writing a book about that, and had this slow dawning realization that the very stories I had covered in India were happening but in reverse here. And there were people more and more fatalistic and hopeless about their place. And I started casting around for ways to tell that story and was just captivated from the beginning, not just by the story of a man who could have been angry and instead forgave, but really behind that about the story of the collision of two different Americas.
I remember those attacks. I mean, I certainly remember 9/11. And I also remember these attacks. And I remember each of them being, you know, a story, you know, a page, a couple paragraphs. I mean, maybe more if you lived in the area where these things took place. And then the trajectory that the story takes. Mark Stroman is tried. He is convicted of these attacks. Race has this whole other thing that happens after this. I mean, lots of things happen to him that I don't think anybody really knew about.
You're right that a lot of people paid attention at that moment of these crimes all over the country, some in Arizona, some in Texas, some elsewhere. The thing that was amazing to me is what made it a really American saga, as opposed to just a sad and bad story of hate crimes, was actually what happened to them afterward out of the limelight. And they both went on journeys over the next 10 years. Before this forgiveness thing happened. And Mark Stroman's journey was to get sentenced to death and to go to death row. And in the solitude of death row, with all of the bad influences from his life suddenly out of his life, all of the new people who come into his life, from religious ministers to documentary filmmaker to new friends, pen pals, all the new people are great influences, he becomes a better guy. And you see him melting. You see him becoming self-aware. You see him understanding what made him like this. Meanwhile, over those same 10 years, Reis Bouillon has this spectacular American reinvention, you know, gets kicked out of the hospital the day after going in because I guess being shot in the face was a pre-existing condition before Obamacare, and is then casting around for medicine from free samples, but rebuilds as much as he can on the health front, rebuilds economically, finds some guy who finds another guy, works at the Olive Garden, as he put it, to help him overcome his fear of white people. The Olive Garden's a good place for that. And is able over the years to get six-figure work in IT in Dallas after this journey. And so both of them go on this road of 10 years. And then, 10 years in, kind of dramatically re-enter each other's lives.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with New York Times columnist Anand Giridharadas about his new book, The True American: Murder and Mercy in Texas. Reis Bouillon came to public attention again when he decided to argue against the death penalty for Mark Stroman. We actually have some tape of this from NPR's All Things Considered, where he talked to one of my colleagues back in 2011, and here it is.
According to my faith in Islam, there is no hate, no killing. It doesn't allow anything like that. Yes, Mark Stroman did a horrible thing, and he brought a lot of pain and disaster, sufferings in my life. But in return, I never hated him, and by hating him, it's not going to bring any good solution to the society, but if he's forgiven, who knows?
Now, at this point, he'd never met Mark Stroman other than the time that he shot him in the face. And he was not connected to advocacy groups or anything like that. I mean, how do you explain this? Was this purely for his own spiritual growth? How do you explain it?
I think there were two things that happened. One that has to do with his faith, and the other that has to do with his status and observer of America as an immigrant. So the first thing with his faith is when he was dying, or thought he was dying, in the gas station, laying on the floor in his own blood, he, as many of us would, looked up to the sky. As it happened, he was a religious guy, but the secular would probably do the same in that moment, and said, God, if you save me, I'll give you everything. I'll serve others for the rest of my life if you save me. And God did save him. And yet he couldn't serve him for the next many years because he had to worry about his eye and his health and his $60,000 of debt and all of that. But at some point that passed and he got work again and he paid off his debt and he was whole and he was ready and he went on the pilgrimage to Mecca. And there in Mecca, very clearly had this sense that God was kind of calling in that old favor and saying, look, buddy, I saved you. You said you'd spend your life serving others. This is the time. And so had a strong sense that he had to do something for others. Now, so that's one of the two tracks. The second track was, all this time he'd been trying to figure out, what's going on in this society of mine? Was this just an isolated guy who was crazy? Or is there something going on in this society that allowed there to be a Mark Stroman? Hmm. And the longer he stayed in America, the more he worked at the Olive Garden, actually learned about his colleagues' lives at the Olive Garden, which appalled him. Many of their lives similar to Mark Stroman's childhood. Not very happy. The more he learned about the kind of ravages of drugs in the corner of America that he was in, he realized that what had happened was not a fluke, that there was a really hurting undernation in this country, and that Mark Stroman was the worst expression of a tendency that was wider than him. And the combination of those two streams forced him to come to this realization that I'm going to forgive this guy, but I want to do something bigger than forgiving him. I want to fight a campaign to save him, to show people that there's another way.
Hmm. You know, this is a very richly reported story. There is a tremendous detail, not just detail of things that happened, but detail around people's feelings and things that you would never think about. Like, for example, with Reis Bouillon, the fact that he lost his fiancée because of this, because he didn't have any opportunity to, because he was ill and he couldn't go back to Bangladesh to follow through on the wedding. And so there was a real cost that was paid on either side. And also Mark Stroman was a father, and the fact that he had children. I don't want to give it all away, but I do want to ask you, what do you want the rest of us to learn from this journey that both of these men went on after being brought together in this really terrible way?
You know, I think as powerful as this story is, if it was just a story about two guys, I wouldn't have spent the last 3 years of my life on it. To me, it's a story about a man who was shot and got blind in one eye and yet was able to see something that most of the rest of us in America are in denial about, which is that there's an extraordinary number of us that have fallen so far out of the good life. And it's not just a lack of jobs, but it includes a lack of jobs. It's not just the breakdown of the family, but it includes the breakdown of the family. It's not just schools that are failing or any number of other problems. It's all of these problems. And it's meth, and it's all kinds of things. And Race, through his strange journey, was put face to face with this rotting part of the country, even as the other part of the country that still works and arguably works better than anywhere else in the world still served him very well. He was shot in the face, and he still got his American dream. He still was able to rise up, get education, learn, get help, make six figures, buy a house,
become a player, be heard, have a voice,
get on NPR,
get some people to listen to him.
And so he has lived the America that I still believe, and I think he believes, and a lot of us believe, is not just okay, but really works better than any society's ever worked in human history still. But he was put face to face, as many of us from that America are not, with the rotting America that has stopped working some time ago and that we choose to drive past.
Anand Giridharadas is author, most recently, of The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. And he was kind enough to join us here in our studios in Washington, D.C. Anand, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This Independence Day, we are bringing you encore conversations with guests who spent a lot of time thinking about freedom, specifically the freedom to choose who they are and what they believe in. For our next conversation, we're visiting with a woman who's not American, but her work resonated with us. She's trying to bring fresh thinking to the question of faith and public life in her home country, which is England. In 2012, Baroness Sayeeda Varsi became the United Kingdom's first ever Minister of State for Faith and Communities. She previously made history as the first Muslim to serve in a British cabinet when she was appointed by Prime Minister David Cameron in 2010. I caught up with her earlier on a visit to the U.S. where she was talking about promoting religious freedom around the world. Her official title now is Senior Minister of State at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and Minister for Faith and Community. When we spoke, Baroness Varsi explained how she saw her mission in the U.K.
The last Archbishop of Canterbury actually put it incredibly well when he said that sometimes faith in the United Kingdom is seen as the preserve of minorities, oddities and foreigners. As a British Muslim, as somebody who is from a minority faith within a majority Christian country, I feel that my faith is strengthened and easier to practice if the sense of identity, the Christian identity within Britain is also clear. I don't feel that people have to be less Christian to accommodate my Muslim belief.
I think a lot of people around the world remember the violent attack in London when a man viciously attacked a soldier with a hatchet. The man said on video, which was recorded by a passersby, that this was in retaliation for the British military presence in Muslim countries. And then it's been reported since then that there have been a number of sort of retaliatory attacks on Muslims and sites important to Muslims. What is your role in addressing this? I mean, you have a sense really that there's a lot of anger and fear, you know, on both sides. Is part of your job to alleviate that? And if so, how?
Yeah, a big part of my job is to actually make sure that we develop and respond to tackling hate crime, religious hate crime being a large part of that. We have an incredibly good history of tackling anti-Semitism in the United Kingdom. And the issue of Islamophobia, the rise of Islamophobia in recent times has been a worrying challenge. But I'm delighted to say that actually we've been the government that's dealt with this issue more than any government before. As I did a speech, which was actually quite controversial back in 2011, when I said that Islamophobia had passed the dinner table test. And what I meant by that was, unfortunately, this creeping form of bigotry was being found in the most civilized of settings. For example, example, our dinner tables.
So it had become accepted, in your view?
It had, and therefore we needed to respond, and we've responded in a number of ways, and both proactively and reactively respond to challenges that may arise. And the backlash towards the British Muslim community after the tragic murder of drummer Lee Rigby, the murder that you mentioned on the streets of London, was exactly one of those cases. And what we found, interestingly, after that tragic murder was that we found a unified British Muslim community who was unequivocal in its condemnation of this attack.
But what about the people who do feel that their country is changing in ways that they don't like? I mean, for example, the whole question of full face coverings, veils. I know you've spoken about that mm-hmm. issue. I know that, you know, France has taken the position that these kind of full face coverings should just not be permitted in the public sphere, particularly in public places. You've taken a different perspective. But what about people who say, look, I don't want to deal with a bank teller whose face is covered. I don't want to deal with a school bus driver whose face is covered. I don't want to deal with a teacher in my children's elementary school whose face is covered. I don't want that.
Well, first of all, Britain isn't France, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, that's been established. I understand that. I know I'm an American, but I do know that. I just meant by way of contrast, because those are things that have been well in the news.
I think what I meant was that actually it's a good thing that we are different, in the sense that I think we have a very different approach to faith in the public sphere generally, I mean, irrespective of its approach towards Islam. But I think, you know, sometimes we can get hung up on what I call our symbols and clothing. You know, I have never walked into a bank in the United Kingdom and seen a cashier with a face veil. I have never got on a bus and seen any bus driver with a face veil. It is worn by a tiny minority of a minority. And I therefore think that sometimes the opposition to that is just a rejection of the other, because somehow that clothing is a threat to the person's identity. And what I'm saying, and what I have said, and what I will be saying here in the US, is that your own identity is not strengthened by rejecting the identity of another person. Look, I don't wear the face veil. My mother never wore the face veil. My grandmother never wore the face veil. I can't imagine that my daughter will wear the face veil. But I do, as a woman, absolutely defend the right of a woman to wear what she wants. And as I said, you know, having kind of fought the battle on being told by men that our skirts were too short, I'm certainly not going to be told that our veils are too long. And look, if there is an issue of security, absolutely, the veil should be removed. If there's an issue of health and safety, the veil should be removed. If there's an issue of identity, the veil should be removed. If somebody is given evidence in court, they should be asked to remove their veil. These are very practical approaches in everyday life. And nobody is saying that that shouldn't happen. Of course that should happen. You know, you wouldn't go in and work with, say, food products and not, you know, be able to kind of work with coverings either on your hands, arms, you know, face. But I also feel that people who reject this are not doing it for those reasons, that it's in a rejection of the other. And that is, I think, deeply dangerous, because where do you stop in terms of saying, well, I don't like that about you, and I don't like that dress, and I don't like what you eat, and I don't like what you say, and I don't. And it's a creeping bigotry, which I think we've got to fight.
If you're just joining us, it's our weekly Faith Matters conversation. I'm speaking with Baroness Sayeeda Varacy. She is the United Kingdom's first ever Minister of State for Faith and Communities. Talk to me, if you would, about your initiative around the persecution of Christians around the world. Do you mean in predominantly Muslim environments, or do you mean other places as well? And why have you taken this on?
I think it's all around the world. I think a large part of it is in places where there is a majority Muslim community. But if you look, for example, in India, where, you know, there's been a Christian community since the time of the apostles, there's still a persecution of Christians. And what really kind of worries me is that, one, I think we're not making the proper historical case of where religions have coexisted incredibly well. Yes, of course, there have always been moments in history where religions have been at each other, but there have been great periods of history where religions have coexisted. And we need to make sure that there is a contextualized approach to history, and that full history is put before people.
But how effective, given that this government going back through previous governments, I mean, the UK going back before Mr. Cameron's tenure, has taken policy positions that are often in support of United States positions, which many of these countries are offended by. I mean, do you really feel you can be effective in sounding the alarm about, you know, tolerance when there are so many policy issues in which people are already angry? at the UK. I'm just asking, how effective do you think you can be?
I think you can be. And I think that, you know, what we mustn't do is allow the world to creep into the sense of collective punishment. I mean, one of the challenges that we have, for example, in places like Pakistan is that, you know, what is perceived as US or UK or Western policy is therefore seen as an opposition to that. It's seen as a legitimate reason to persecute their own Christian community. I think, tragically, we see some of that in the West as well, where some, you know, idiot in the name of Islam does something appalling, and then somehow British Muslims or US Muslims as hell somehow have to stand up and be accountable for and apologise for the actions of their co-religionists. So I think the concept of collective punishment we need to move away from. And I also want to make the case that, look, you know, the persecution of Christians should not be a Christian issue, that actually as a British Muslim it should offend me and stir me as much as it would a British Christian. And therefore it's only when people start speaking up, not for their own grouping or their own co-religionists, but actually speak up. I have spoken up sometimes to much criticism on the issue of Islamophobia in the West, and I feel therefore it is as much of my duty to speak up in relation to minority communities around the world as it is to speak up for Muslims in the West.
That was Baroness Sayeeda Varsi. She is the British Minister of State for Faith and Communities. She joined us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Now we want to talk about the freedom to create. We're talking fashion here with designer B. Michael. Even if you don't attend the Paris fashion shows or Fashion Week in New York, you're likely to have seen his work. His hats were featured in the hit television show Dynasty, his clothes in movies, including Whitney Houston's wardrobe in her last film, Sparkle. His client list continues to feature Hollywood royalty and red carpet stars, including Cicely Tyson, Angela Bassett, Halle Berry, Kate Blanchett, and Beyoncé. But B. Michael has also made his mark as one of a handful of top-tier African-American designers. When we spoke, he told me how he got his start as a fashion designer.
I started as a millinery designer. So locally, I was creating millinery, and it came to the attention of Nolan Miller, who was the costumer for Dynasty. And fast forward, I ended up being the milliner for the Dynasty Millinery Collection.
How have you stayed in the business? I mean, even some very big names have struggled when the economy has struggled in recent years. How have you managed to stay in business all this time?
Certainly, as an artist and as a business, you go through ups and downs and reinvent yourself. But every successful story will tell you they've had to reinvent themselves and they've had to find ways of keeping their point of view out there. And that's a challenge, but it's a determination at the same time.
You presented at the Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week in New York City, but you and Tracy Reese, as I recall, were the only two African-Americans helming your own brands who presented. Why aren't there more B. Michaels?
We are first generation in many instances, as we are in other industries that we're going into. We don't have Dutch uncles who open the door for us and sit us down and say, this is what needs to happen, or this is the direction that you should go in.
And what does a Dutch uncle mean? Like a kind of a mentor? Do you mean a financial advisor? Do you mean more of a kind of advice?
I think it's all of that. I think it's about mentoring. It's certainly not talking about, are you talented? Because that's subjective. It's about understanding the business of fashion and understanding you need to have the right team and you need to be financially secure and really understanding the relationships that you have to have with retailers and all of those layers. Those are the lessons that we really need to learn, particularly as designers who do not, you know, where we are creating our own generation in the business.
You know, it has been suggested, though, that things are actually going backward for African Americans in the fashion industry. For example, the model Naomi Campbell, former models Imam and Beth Ann Hardison, sent out a letter in which they condemned the fashion houses for not showing black models or for using just one in a whole collection. There are collections that hadn't used a black model in years. People are saying fashion is global. Some of the most important style
Absolutely.
Icons in America and around the world are people of color. And they're saying, when you don't acknowledge that, it's almost like you're making a statement by not using models of color. So the question I have to ask you is, do you think it's true that in some ways African-Americans in the industry on the whole are going backwards?
I think there are some people who do think that way, and certainly people in power who perhaps that might be an agenda. We have to see it as an opportunity to see, you know, view it as a challenge, but certainly not be crippled by it. For me, I think what we want to overcome, for instance, is being labeled an African-American model or an African-American designer. One of the things that's important is that we are an American designer or an American model or whatever it is that we're doing. Certainly, when we're listing other models or talking about a designer, we don't necessarily put their ethnic, you know, their ethnicity in front of what it is that they are. We don't say
Calvin Klein, the white designer.
Correct.
Donna Karan, the white designer.
Precisely. Precisely.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with top-tier fashion designer B. Michael. We spoke at the launch of his ready-to-wear line in Macy's. Speaking of Macy's, and Barney's has been in the headlines because
yes.
There are two African-American customers who say that they were wrongly and were wrongly accused of shoplifting or not being. Basically, the implication was they couldn't afford the items that they were buying, and they were then followed out of the store by undercover or police officers. So it was a kind of an ugly scene. Has made the news. It occasioned some high level interest. I mean, for example, the Reverend Al Sharpton, the civil rights activist and talk show host, had a meeting with Barney's CEOs as a consequence of this. And I just wanted to ask, what's your take on this whole scene?
When something like that happens, we have to use it as an awareness opportunity. I think we need to be very candid when we describe what happened so that we do understand that there is still that attitude, perhaps, or that thought in terms of what people might experience. And, you know, so I think it's important to showcase and bring to light whenever such an experience happens to anyone.
Has that ever happened to you? Have you? My suspicion is that you shop in
yes.
high-end places, my assumption. That would be my working assumption.
Good assumption.
And so has that ever happened to you?
Well, I cannot say that I've had that happen in such a blatant way, but whether it's in a restaurant or in a hotel, we have all, many of us, I should say, have had similar experiences. And I have, you know, with maturity, found ways to respond to it so that it's effective, because you can never let it just happen and not call it out, but you also don't want to be on the level of the person that inflicted that on you. You want to take it as an opportunity to say, you know what, this is what you just did, and this is what this means.
Does it surprise you, though, that we're still having these conversations at a time when, you know, we have, as we said, an African-American president, the First Lady has been renowned for her style and her look. So many major figures in pop culture are African-American right now. I'm thinking of Beyonce, who's one of your clients, if you don't mind my mentioning that. Halle Berry, people of that sort. And yet, what's going on? That these are people who are in the public eye every single day, and yet people are going into stores who look like them and are being told that they can't afford X, Y, or Z. In fact, Oprah, you know,
right.
Who does not know Oprah, has said that she's similar. She's had the same experience.
Much of it, I think, becomes a distraction. Because while we are happy to talk about it, and the media certainly has a responsibility to report about it, it is still a distraction. Because what's really, I mean, I think a better question to Barney's would be, how many manufacturers or designers of color do you feature in your store? I mean, what equity are we getting out of the fashion industry as a consumer, I think, is a better question. And I'd rather have that conversation and not be distracted by, you know, the ignorance of a security guard or of a person working behind a counter, because that really is a distraction.
Why is that? Isn't that the way most people engage with these stores? Most people engage with these stores as consumers. Doesn't that affect a lot more people?
Well, that is very true. But if we empower the manufacturers and we own a store, then perhaps you'll have a different experience, because then that's a different playing field. And so I really would rather, you know, if you have more black designers who are successful, you would have more black models on the runway. So I think, you know, let's not always talk about the effect and really go underneath and talk some more about the cause. Because if someone at the top is running a Barney's, then it will filter down to the people who work in Barney's on how to respect all kinds of people.
B. Michael is one of America's premier fashion designers. We caught up with him on a visit to Washington, D.C. when he stopped by our studios. For this 4th of July, we've been bringing you conversations about freedom. In this country, that can mean redefining who you are, maybe more than once. So we thought we'd wrap up this holiday broadcast with a treat suitable for any occasion, whether you're cooking out or dining in, because it's an encore conversation with a singer whose voice has soared across gospel, nightclubs, the R&B charts, and Broadway. Jennifer Holliday starred as the original Effie in the musical Dreamgirls. Her version of And I'm Telling You I'm Not Going is the standard against which all other versions are judged. After her stint on Broadway, she went on to a recording career, but she was also battling a number of personal challenges. After more than two decades out of the recording studio, though, she returned with a project called The Song Is You. Why can't I let you know the song my heart would sing? Music is sweet, the words are true, the song is you, yeah. That's the title track from Jennifer Holliday's album, The Song Is You. When we sat down to speak, I told her it was hard to believe that such a big voice came from such a tiny body.
You know, I used to be a big girl. I used to weigh almost 400 pounds. A lot of people try to act like they don't remember, but they're not old enough to remember.
It's just hard to imagine.
Well, Dreamgirls was 33 years ago, so it is. If you weren't there, then I guess a lot of people only remember me now since my Ally McBeal years. So yes. That's what most people know me from now.
What was it like being back in the recording studio after such a long hiatus?
It was very difficult. First of all, because when I went in, they record now to a little box.
And so when I first went in, and my producer, he's a young man, about 20-something years younger than me, and he said, Jennifer, what's wrong? I said, they're disrespecting me. And he said, what do you mean?
I said, they don't have the tape up. They don't have anything ready.
He said, Jennifer, everything goes into this Pro Tools now. I said, I don't need my voice fixed.
What do you mean Pro Tools? I don't need to be tuned or anything.
They said, no, calm down. So it took me a long time that everything. So now my whole future is in a little box in a safe. I mean, I'm just like, what happened to all of the tape?
You know, normally when people do a new album, their publicists, no disrespect to your publicists, but they normally produce background materials, which are normally just, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yours is like a real conversation. It's like real information about how you really felt and how you really came to it. Just to give people a sample of it, you said, you're quoted as saying, for many years, I thought I just seemed to miss when it came to my recording career. I've made some records that were popular in clubs. I've had some near misses with a few R&B records. Then at a time when I really needed work, I was fortunate that Marvin Hamlisch invited me to sing with different symphony orchestras, and he cared so much about me that he allowed me to reinvent myself artistically. It goes on, you know, from there. It's like people can kind of hear that big band sound in the first piece. First, I was fascinated by why you just put it all out there. You just like, this is how I feel. This is what happened.
Isn't life like that, though? Haven't a lot of us just missed at a lot of things and thought that we wouldn't have another chance at it? So we give up early. So in the process of recording this album, which took me a long time, again, I'm met with setbacks and trying to get it out. And I had many missed release dates because of so many things in the way. I have health challenges. I have life challenges, just like everyone else. So I think I wanted to just mainly just say to people that this album is a return for me, but it's more so of how we want to win at life. So yes, you have near misses in love, but does that mean you give up on love entirely? Does that mean you give up on life entirely? So yes, I put quite a bit more that you didn't read out there.
Let's play one of the first songs from the album. Want to play Love Dance? Shall we start there?
Yes,
yeah, let's
start
hear that.
There.
Okay, here it is.
We loved, we slept, we kept the lights on. Ooh.
people hear that famous Jennifer Holliday power about to spring. Mm-hmm. But you also hear a lot of range, a lot of nuance, kind of the quiet moments. So talk about that. Was that part of the fun for you?
That was part of the fun, to let people, you know, and I've had a pretty much of a reclusive life, and the fact that a lot of people don't know a lot about me, where I've been or what I've done. A lot of people think that I just stopped singing, but I didn't stop singing. Just the audience that has changed, and it took me away from the public eye, where I just started doing a lot of private engagements. During the course of the time, though, I got to learn a lot more about new music. So Marvin Hamlisch, the late Marvin Hamlisch from Broadway and movies and et cetera, he said, you know what? You would sound good singing with an orchestra. He said, but you have to sing different music and you'd have to get charts. So fortunately, orchestras book 6 months or a year ahead, so it gave me a time to learn. So I went back to school, bought lots of albums and studied Ella Fitzgerald and even Lena Horne and Billie Holiday and all of these people who I'd never really paid that much attention to, because see, I came from Texas and sang in the Baptist Church choir, so all I knew was Aretha Franklin. So if Aretha didn't sing it, I didn't sing it. Okay, I didn't know it.
That's really brave. That's very brave to go and reinvent yourself at a point at which you're already successful. But that's not the only area in which you've shown, I think, a lot of courage. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with the award-winning singer and now in this album songwriter, Jennifer Holliday. We're talking about her forthcoming album, The Song Is You, and whatever else is on your mind. I just have to say that you've been very brave in talking about a lot of things that artists commonly talk about now, but were not talked about when you were first dealing with them. Things like your struggles with depression, multiple sclerosis, and even the whole vagaries of weight and how that played into your career. Is it still a struggle? Do you feel like it's something that you have to,
you have to hide.
Hide.
Yeah.
A little bit.
I think it is, because otherwise I don't think that these young people would be taking such great lengths to be someone other than who they are and live such destructive lives. I'm 53 years old. I never thought that I would be sitting here talking to you. I used to think, I said to myself, I probably would have had a much better career if I could invent myself something to go into rehab. Because if you're an alcoholic or drug addict, it's just a sexier thing. And it's just a more acceptable thing. But mental health problems still gets the door shut.
What's made the difference for you, though, in your being willing and able to battle this? And I know it's a lifelong battle.
You know, not only did I try to take my own life, but those of us who are in the spiritual world, others have tried to take my life as well. But God made the difference for me in the sense that he held on to me to love me so much to keep leaving me here. But I still had to choose life, though. I had to fight for it. I continually still fight every day for my life, not only still battling mental health problems, but battling multiple sclerosis, which also has depression as one of its side effects. So every day when I wake up, I don't know what day is going to be. I have been blind. I have been paralyzed. But each day, if I wake up, then I know he's left me here for a reason, and I have to say yes. Mm. And I have to get up, and I have to make the best of that day.
And the weight loss, how did that figure into that? And has that been its own a journey for you?
Or that has been a separate journey in and of itself. After my suicide attempt, and I'm in a sanatorium, and when they come around and they start talking to you, first of all, they want to know, why did you try to take your life? What do you think is the problem? So one of the problems that I felt, that I had just really been dropped by Geffen Records and didn't know what I was going to do with my career, and I just kept gaining more and more weight. I had ballooned up to 345 pounds. It was the age of videos, you know, we had just started. So they said, well, Jennifer, you can sing, but you're unattractive. So if we make a video of you, we'd have to stretch you or put you in a shadow box and put people around you. And that was the 80s, so dance music was coming up and all of this kind of stuff, you know. So they were like, you know, we can't make videos with you. So you got a great voice, but no use for you. So they kicked me to the curb, you know. And so I said, so that would help. I said, Probably I could have a boyfriend if I lost weight. I could have a relationship. It would just be all right. So they said, well, there's this new surgery. It has not been approved yet. And that was the gastric bypass. I was one of the first to have that. So I did that. I lost weight really quickly. Lost all the weight. Found out I still had the same issues. Still had the same problems.
200 pounds smaller, same issues, okay? Baggage still there. Back to counseling.
Good message there. At least you settle the question for those
Back
who want
to counseling.
Know. Well, congratulations on all of that, though.
Thank
and
you.
And again, what else do you want to hear from the album? Was there something on the album that means that particularly meaningful for you that you want to hear?
Well, the album deals with love and relationships. So it starts off with love dance and things like that of the romance of it, where you're flirting and love is wonderful, you fall in love. Then it goes from that point to where you have to really fall in love with people as they are, and you have complications and you work things out, and then some things don't work out and you break up. So one song that I wrote is called The One You Used to Be. And I wrote this song because about a little over 2 years ago, I was in a relationship and had a very bad breakup. Mm. As with a lot of people, once you get married, the person who you didn't know or you thought you knew becomes totally different. And that could be with me, too. He probably could have said the same thing about me, but he didn't, okay? But anyway. Okay, he didn't say that, all
he
right?
Didn't say that,
no, he didn't.
I'll take your word.
Okay, he'll tell you that he messed up. But anyway, so I wrote this song just about how sometimes people change and it just destroys everything. And you wish you could get it back, but you aren't able to get it back. The other thing, too, where I was saying with the lyrics, it says, don't take away my memories. Just let me hold on to the one you used to be. And the reason why I ended it like that, because sometimes the breakups are worse because we try to not only just break up. It's one thing to break up and leave. It's all right if you want to go. But why do we have to try to say that they didn't have anything? Because what does that mean? If they didn't have anything, you wouldn't have been drawn to that. You know what I'm saying? So
sure.
There must have been something of value that a person has that they could take to the next relationship and say, okay, you're terrible at this, but let me tell you what you're good at. And maybe the next one you could develop whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
You know, but why do we have to destroy a person in the
sense? I don't know. It's just, you're right. There's some people like that. They can't just say, well, it's not working out.
Yeah,
it's got to be your horrible.
Well, then go, just go.
Yeah.
You know, wrong. The problem with you is, well, no, that's not the problem with me. That's not my problem. No, it's not.
It's just not. Let's just say it's just not working
just
out.
Not working just not working out. Just anyway. Go head on.
Well, thank you for coming over to see us. We sure do appreciate it. You know, I wanted to ask you, you've already been dropping some knowledge throughout our conversation, but I did want to ask, as a person who's had such an interesting journey, if you had some wisdom that you wanted to pass on.
A lot of times we base everything just on our immediate circumstance. We don't see a big picture for our lives. We don't love ourselves. We don't have a way of kind of gauging the future, so we count it loss, which is what I think is with the young people, because they get so much so quick now that they go, okay, well, it can't get no better than this. Let's just chuck away life. Let's just kill ourselves. Let's destroy, because it can't get any better than this. I've already had sex. I've already had drugs. I've already lost a job. I've already seen my parents get divorced. I've already da-da. What else is there left? But there is life left. something that we don't even know ahead of us. And at 53 years old, just when I thought that every dream, every hope, even new love, I haven't had time to talk to you about that, but I have love again.
Oh, all right. You know? Glad to hear that.
I'm so glad myself to hear that. But what I'm saying is that don't try to figure out the ending of the movie. Stay to see it. Don't try to figure out how the book ends, because it takes different twists and turns. And how do we adapt to each twist and turn? Just because I'm a singer doesn't mean I'm better than someone else. You know, I'd be so wealthy now just if I could sell singing. But I can't. If you can't sing, you can't sing. I got nothing I can do for you, you know? But that doesn't mean I'm better than you. That doesn't mean that the gift that I have is better than your gift. Let's find out what your gift is. And I tell people my favorite thing is it'll get greater later, but you got to stick around to see your life turn around. If you don't stick around, then you'll never know.
I'm not going to answer all that hate mail if I don't play a little bit from... And I'm telling you.
You got to do it.
I'm not going.
I have to listen. I don't mind. And I sing it at every concert. I don't make people beg for it or plead okay. or roll on the floor or pay extra money, because it has allowed me. It's a great love song, but it's also a song of survival. And I'm telling you, I'm not going nowhere.
I've been visiting with the Tony and Grammy award-winning artist Jennifer Holliday. Her album is called The Song Is You. But we're going to hear from that song. Jennifer Holliday, thank you so much for speaking with us
thank
and visiting
you.
With us today.
Thank you so much. And I am